Gifford pivoted sharply and homed in on a dark spot in the cliff.
She screamed the first time, Ivor said, his voice emanating from the dark. Grandmother, how Rhianna could howl. I stuffed rags in her mouth after that. Didn't want the neighbours to hear.
Gifford ran forward and nearly clipped his head on the top of the tunnel as he came upon them. Roan sat at the feet of Ivor, who squatted on a flat rock near the middle of his little chamber. Ivor lacked any light, but Roan still glowed a bit. Her light illuminated Ivor's sagging face and empty eyes, the visage of a melting monster. Roan's cheeks glistened with tears. Gifford advanced. Roan turned and raised her hands. Gifford, no! Ivor scuttled backward, watching him with eyes that weren't circles anymore, but rather tall, stretched ovals, a pair of black, empty sockets.
I'll make certain he never takes you again.
Gifford moved in. Roan grabbed him, her fingers clutching his leg. He didn't! I came here. I came to him. Gifford stopped.
What? Why?
Roan sniffled as she looked up at him. Her eyes were puffed and red, the ends of her hair wet and chewed. She quivered with emotion, and her fingers squeezed his leg as if he were a floating piece of debris and she were drowning.
For Bryn,
Roan shook even harder. Gifford was dumbfounded. He looked at the cowering, sagging flesh of Ivor, and then back at Roan.
Is she? She's... Oh, Elan, she's going mad. Roan is losing her mind to the abyss.
Gifford's light dimmed.
Bryn? I don't understand.
We promised. I promised. I told Bryn I wouldn't stop trying to find a way out. I've thought and I've thought, and all I can come up with is that the answer lies with Ivor. He's been the problem my whole life. I thought it was guilt, the guilt I suffered from killing him.
What? You came to get forgiveness from him?
Gifford glared at the wallowing pile of flesh that had once been the worst kind of man.
That wasn't it, but he is the one who is keeping me here.
Gifford let out a false laugh.
Oh, I can fix that. I can rid you of him real quick.
He drew his sword. Ivor cringed, lifting saggy arms in defense.
No, don't!
Roan shrieked so loudly that it scared both of them.
You still don't understand.
Gifford understood just fine. Roan was losing her mind, and Ivor was speeding up the process. He had been the one who broke Roan in the first place, and now he was doing it all over again. He'd always hated himself for not saving Roan when they lived in Dol Ren. It didn't matter that he was a cripple or that interfering with a master's treatment of his slave wasn't allowed. No one had actually known what was going on in Ivor's roundhouse. But Gifford felt that he should have figured it out and done something. Now the Abyss was presenting the opportunity to make up for past failures.
He'll never be able to hurt you again.
It's not him!
Roan sputtered as more tears fell from her eyes.
It's not anything he is doing. It's me. What I'm doing.
He's got her again.
Gifford had never understood the hold Ivor had on Roan and her mother. If it had been Moya in that roundhouse, she would have worn Ivor's head for a hat. But Roan and Rhianna were timid. Their wills, their sense of themselves, had been eroded by years of degradation. Now he was doing it all over again. He was using guilt and fear to...
Don't you see, Gifford? I'm the one at fault here.
No, Roan, you aren't. That's just what he wants you to think. That's how he controls and manipulates. He steals your sense of self-worth. Ivor belittles and demeans until you think his beatings and abuses are your fault, but they're not. He's the evil one, not you. You're the victim.
Roan's eyes went wide, and she nodded.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Thank the grandmother. I'm still able to reach her.
That's it. That's the problem. Thank you, Gifford. You're right. I am the victim. I always have been.
Gifford was surprised this was coming as such a revelation.
Even geniuses have blind spots, I guess.
I have to stop being the victim,
Roan said with grave seriousness. There's only one way to do that. Give me your sword.
Gifford understood and handed her the blade. He deserves it, Roan. Remember that?
Roan stood up and raised the sword in both hands, facing Ivar, who continued to cower like a squirrel in a rainstorm.
What you did,
she told Ivar in a shaking voice,
to me and my mother during all those years of torture is something that no one should endure.
She looked at Gifford.
Even though I'm married to the most wonderful, loving, caring man in the world, I still have nightmares because I can't get out from under your shadow or escape my pain. I've hated you for so long, and I've never realized that in doing so, I was dragging you with me. All my hate was tied with fear, regret, and shame. It all made an unbreakable knot that I would never be able to untie. That's the weight that I carry. The one I've always shouldered.
She reached Ivar, who stared at her with his dark, elongated eyes that didn't look so monstrous now. They looked terrified.
Roan, Ivar said. I know I did bad by you.
Oh, this hurts, she whispered.
Gifford wondered if she knew she was speaking aloud.
Grandmother of all, give me strength,
Roan prayed. She dropped the sword and took a step forward. As she did, Gifford saw fresh tears spilling down her cheeks.
Killing you didn't set me free. Doing it again won't either.
Her light wavered.
Roan, what are you doing?
The hardest thing I've ever done, she said, her words barely audible.
Roan, I...
Ivar stammered.
Shh,
Roan said as she came closer and knelt.
Ivar,
she said the words gently, as if she were speaking to a child rather than to someone who'd done countless unspeakable horrors.
You are a terrible man, a truly despicable person, but you're not anymore. You're dead. And it's not like I haven't done my own terrible things. I murdered you, even though I could have run away, or at least tried to, but I didn't.
She took a steadying breath.
And while you didn't mean to kill my mother, I killed you on purpose. I wanted you dead. So I took your life.
She shook her head.
None of us is perfect. Least of all me. Everyone makes mistakes. The point is to learn from them.
Padera used to say, there's always a better way. And she was right. Roan reached out and put her hand to Ivar's cheek.
You see, I finally figured it out. I want to hate you for all the things you did. But that's just me hanging on to pain. If I wish to be truly free, I have to let it go.
She nodded.
Ivar,
she took a breath.
I forgive you, Ivar.
She leaned in and kissed him.
I truly and honestly do.
Gifford stared in wonder as Roan put her arms around the carver and held him close as they both cried. As they rocked, Roan's light stopped flickering, quit wavering, and began to grow. By the time they left Ivor's cave, Roan was so brilliant that Gifford had trouble looking at her. He was brighter too, and together they lit up the open expanse from cliff to cliff. Together they walked hand in hand back across the frost. As they did, Clifford realized he felt lighter than he had even before Bryn left. He was thinking of this and staring across at the base of the pillar when Roan abruptly stopped. Her head was up, her eyes wide. She pointed. Look! Look! Tilting his head, Gifford searched the blackness overhead and was stunned to see a light. Together they watched as something bright flashed overhead. It looked like a falling star, except that it streaked left to right, from the top of the pillar toward the plain of Kilcorth. Bryn, they said in unison. She did it! Gifford clapped. She's going back, Roan said. She's going home. Tesh was groggy and squinting in pain at the bright light. For a moment he thought Bryn had returned, but the light came from Roan, whom he could barely see amid her brilliance. Gifford too looked brighter, but Roan was a star. Bryn did it, Gifford told them, and Roan has figured out how we can too. There isn't anything pressing us down. The weight is what we carry, Roan explained. We have no bodies, but our spirits are crushed by our regret, our hate, our guilt. We're like people who dive to the bottom of a lake by holding heavy rocks. To get out, all we need to do is drop the rocks. Tesh looked at Tressa, who reflected his skepticism. It's true, Gifford said. Roan forgave Ivor, and when she did, her light, well, you can see for yourself. Then she made me do it, Gifford frowned. Trust me when I say it's not easy. You can't just say it. You have to mean it. You have to accept and believe. It's not, well, it's culling hard is what it is, but not really, you know. Tesh and Tressa shook their heads. What I mean is that... He looked helplessly at Roan, the way he used to when he couldn't find a word without an R sound. He means that doing it isn't physically hard, but it requires admitting you are wrong about something you have always known you were absolutely justified in. That's the battle. You have to fight yourself, sometimes against your own sense of identity. You must sacrifice your pride and dignity as well. It all feels so horribly wrong, like spring giving way to winter, or water falling up. That's what makes it difficult. It goes against everything you believe, but worse, it goes against everything you want to believe. And yet, once you do it, when you let yourself fall, when you give up fighting and just accept that you aren't going to hate anymore, as terrible as that feels to do, the pressure disappears. And you realize it was an illusion, that the hate only existed in you, and keeping it is the same as cherishing an addictive poison that's making you sick. Looking back, it doesn't even make sense. But getting there, crossing that chasm, it just seems too wide to jump until you look back and see it was only a crack. Tesh sat up straighter.
So what?
Tressa asked, her voice groggy, her words slurred.
We all have to give Ivor a hug or something.
No, Roan said. You have to discover what's weighing you down and let go of it. It will be different for everyone. Tesh sat back, considering this. It didn't take much study for him to find his burden. He hated the Frey, the Galantians, and Nephron. Roan was asking him to just forget what he'd lived most of his life for. No, not forget. Forgive. Roan wanted him to kiss Nephron and say, Hey, look, I know you murdered my family, my whole clan, burned our homes to the ground and laughed while you did it, then started a war, letting my people die to serve your selfish ends. But so what? That's all in the past. Friends, you're insane, Tess told them both. I can't do that.
Neither can I,
Tressa said. You can. Roan knelt down, nearly blinding them. You just won't. But if you don't, you'll stay here. Think about the logic of that. You're willing to let them punish you further? To give them the power to ruin you for eternity rather than forgive? Where's the sense?
Not everything makes sense, Tesh threw back.
Yes, it does. If it doesn't, you're probably not looking at it right.
Tesh was shaking his head. What she was asking was impossible. Even if he wanted to, he couldn't.
It's not like I can just turn it off. I've lived my whole life hating them. You're asking me to do magic here? To just wave my hands to erase my memory?
Roan shook her head, making the light shift back and forth. No, actually, that would be too easy. You have to remember. You have to think really hard and pull up all those horrific memories by the roots and then scatter them to the wind.
You're asking me to unmake myself. You're more than hate, Tesh, Giffert told him.
Tesh wasn't at all certain about that. Everything he was had grown from that fountain. His skill as a fighter was born out of his desire for revenge. His leadership of the Techlaws, his fame, his respect, came from his need to kill those who had butchered his people. He had always planned to win the war, to slaughter every living Frey. And when they were all gone, he would find Nephrim and explain how he had returned the favor of annihilating his tribe and burning down his house. Then, and only then, would he kill the focus of his pain. He could never give that up. Never forgive Nephrim and the rest of the Frey. Never.
Tesh, Roan inched closer so that he had to close his eyes. She took his hand in hers.
This was shocking. Roan had never touched anyone except Gifford. With his eyes closed, her small hands felt like they reminded him of...
You promised Bryn, she said.
Tesh opened his eyes and was once more blinded by her light. He jerked his hands away and pushed back, shoving himself down the wall.
Tesh,
Roan called at him out of that horrible light.
That's not fair, he said.
His voice sounded louder than he planned.
But you did promise.
Shut up,
he shouted.
If you get out, there's a chance you'll see her again, Gifford told him. I'll never see her again. We've been here forever. She either succeeded and is back on a land, probably married with kids, or dead and back in Rell with her parents. Her parents and mine. And I'll never see any of them. Ever.
It's not too late, Roan told him. I just saw her. I just saw Bryn.
You're lying!
Roan never lies, Giffert reminded him.
Tesh knew that, yet he couldn't help himself. He was trying to hurt her.
Hurt Roan. What am I doing?
Roan moved close again. I saw Bryn race across the top of the abyss, heading for Rell. You can't mistake her light. I think she succeeded, so she's going home.
We'll never catch her.
If she stops at Midian's castle, which she might, if only to see if we got out or to look for Moya, there might be a chance, if we hurry.
No.
You promised, Roan said.
Quit saying that.
Do you think she knew you were lying to her?
Tressa asked. Tesh cocked his head sharply and glared, feeling strangely betrayed.
So all the stories are true. You really are a bitch, aren't you?
Absolutely,
Tressa replied, with no smile, no hint of humor.
What about you? What great hate is keeping you here?
Tesh fought back. feeling terrible the moment he said it, and worse when he saw Tressa's eyes brimming with tears. He ought to know better. He was facing the same pain. This wasn't a game. The anguish they were experiencing was deep and cruel. Tressa wasn't one for tears, so seeing her eyes glisten showed just how deeply he'd wounded her. But misery was a sickness that insisted on spreading, and like a drowning man, he was willing to shove her under to lift himself up. Tressa looked down at her hands and mashed her lips together, swishing them around in an attempt to fight the tears. Then she squared her jaw as best she could.
I was expelled from Clan Wren, punished for years, made invisible and untouchable for the unforgivable crime of turning a blind eye while my husband murdered Reglan, and then tried to do the same to Persephone. All those people, the self-righteous geniuses, they figured it all out, put all the pieces together, and found me guilty.
She looked up at each of them. They were all wrong.
So you hate them? Gifford asked.
Of course I do, Tressa said.
I despised everyone on that doll for as far back as I can remember. Not for anything that they did, but because they couldn't see the greatness in me. The kicker is, they still don't see me for what I am.
Gifford glanced, confused, at Roan and Tesh.
You don't see it, do you?
Tressa shook her head, frowned, and looked at Roan.
Even the genius hasn't figured it out. Conago wasn't responsible for Reglan's death. Nor did he plan to kill Persephone,
Tressa sighed.
My husband was an idiot who needed help pulling his shirt on in the morning. You have no idea how many times the man nearly choked to death because he couldn't manage something as simple as swallowing. He had no ambition and no mind for planning. But I was tired of living in the pit that Conniger's sister called a house. I wanted the lodge and all those fine things beneath its roof. I longed for people to see me as grand, to be respected. That's why I married Conniger in the first place. I didn't love him, but I knew he could get me what I wanted. And I wanted to be second chair. Honestly, I wanted to be first chair, but I just didn't think that was possible. Little did I know.
What are you saying? Gifford asked. Tressa smirked in disbelief.
You still don't get it. It wasn't Conniger at all. It was me. I killed Reglan, Holliman, Hegner, and Cryer. I even tried my best to kill Persephone. I tried real hard. Conniger did the grunt work, of course, but it was all my idea. I had to force him, threaten and guilt him into it. Oh, the hours I spent belittling his manhood, his courage. Not that he was all that strong to begin with. The man was a fool, but good with an axe. That's why I picked him. He was the perfect tool to get all I wanted.
They all stared in silence.
I had so desired to put that smug Persephone in her place. I planned it for years. I figured out how I could maneuver Conniger into the position of shield. Then, after killing her husband, all I had to do was threaten Maeve. And she declared Conniger would be Reglan's successor. We had to tidy up a bit, of course. Holliman Hunt had to die because he knew too much. But I got my chair. Then the fray came, and everything started to fall apart. I convinced my husband to kill Persephone. I gave Conniger his cloak and sent him on his way. But, as it turns out, he was as inept at murder as he was at swallowing. Persephone knew.
I saw it in her face when she came back. And what did she do?
Tressa's voice was cut off by a closing throat and a shuddering battle against tears.
She made up a story about how Conniger died a hero fighting the bear. Said it right out loud in the courtyard. She did it to be nice to me. No one believed her because it was such a blatant lie. When people saw through it and sensibly blamed me anyway, Persephone told them not to.
Tressa was losing her fight with her tears as one slipped over the brim and slid down her cheek.
Even after all I did, that bitch, Persephone, protected me.
She wiped her face and nose, a sour expression squeezing her cheeks.
So, if you want to know who it is I hate, if you haven't managed to work out this little puzzle, it's really quite easy. It's me. I despise everything about myself. I hate that I was so greedy that I took lives and ruined others. I hate that I returned true kindness with suspicion and anger because I couldn't believe it. Because I would never do such a thing as be helpful for no reason. I hate that I only ever thought of myself and never even got anything for my single-minded efforts. So you see, I'm not leaving, because unlike the rest of you, I belong here. I deserve this. I want this.
Tressa then whirled on Tesh.
So you little culling fool, you have no excuse.
She added a nasty, taunting whine to her voice and said,
So the Frey killed your family. So what? They killed a lot of families. What if a pack of wolves had killed them? Would you devote your life to hunting wolves? And what if it was starvation? Or sickness? Or what if your mother had fallen in a well? Or your father threw thin ice? What then? What then, Tesh? People die. People die all the damn time. You know what else does that? The sun comes up. It rains. Leaves fall. Not here, of course, but back in Elan. Some of it is good, some of it is terrible, but that doesn't mean you throw your life away. Ask yourself this, hero. The revenge you're after. Who is it for? Not your family. Not your clan. They've all put it behind them and are happy in Rell. So who is it really for? Who would ask you to throw your life away, to toss eternal happiness aside for their petty desires of revenge? Ask yourself if a person like that deserves such a sacrifice.
Tressa took a labored breath.
I can tell you, with first-hand knowledge, they don't, because I am that sort of person. I know I'm a bitch. That's why I can't even stand up.
They heard a cough, and in that dark quiet, it rang as loud as a gong. Looking over, they saw a large, drooping man who dragged himself toward them, using the wall for support.
Ivor,
Roan said, surprised. Tesh watched her. He didn't know the circumstances between them, but from the earlier comments, he gathered they weren't friends.
Just thought you ought to know, the man said with effort. It's knowing. So I think they've seen your light. Or maybe Bryn's. I don't know.
Who?
The Typhons,
Ivor said, with the same miserable tone one might expect from a man delivering home the dead body of a loved one. Something was strange about this plump man whose bottom was bigger than his top. His eyes were black and long and, as far as Tesh could tell, empty. He didn't approach, but kept his distance.
Always knows before they come. We hide in the little caves, so they don't eat us.
Ivar's voice had an odd quaver.
Light attracts them.
Gifford looked at Roan, his eyes edging toward panic.
This cave here,
Ivar said, looking around.
It's too big. They can get in. That's why no one took it. You can come to my cave if you like. Can't even get a finger in there. Maybe it will help.
That maybe didn't sound hopeful. We're going to climb out, Roan told him. Aren't we? She asked the rest.
Absolutely, Gifford said. Tesh, you don't want to be eaten, do you?
Tesh shook his head.
Wasn't on my list this morning. So you'll try? Why not? Later on I'll bake a cake in the shape of a castle, and we can eat it while riding on giant swans.
Sounds like a plan.
You can come too, Roan told Ivar. The melted man only shook his head, then held up a wooden figurine.
I wanted to give you this.
Roan took the carving. She stared down at it, and her free hand rose to her lips.
It's my mother. It's beautiful.
I never meant to kill her. And I always wanted to give her back to you. This is the best I can do. Not even certain how I did it. Never been able to do anything like it before. But after you left, after you kissed me, I could.
Ivar turned around, and with dragging feet, headed back into the dark. Chapter 19. Horizontal Star. The secret to Pyre is realizing that the things we think are real in life are fictions in death, and that which we label as intangible fabrications while we are beneath the sun are everything when we are in the dark. The Book of Brynn. As if she sat upon a massive throne, Moya lounged in the crenel between two stone merlons, dangling her legs off the front of Midian's great curtain wall. Crenel. Merlon. Curtain wall. In her time spent in the Belgriclungrian fortress, Moya had added these architectural terms to her vocabulary, along with a dizzying array of dwarven rebukes and profanity. Jobby and ball bag were easy enough to grasp after the first few times she heard them, and she heard them a lot. Yarawi Skunner was a bit harder, but she figured out it meant to call a person a nuisance. For a long time, Moya had no idea what away and bile your head meant. She liked the sound and hoped it was something truly terrible that she might add to her regular repertoire. After finally asking, she was disappointed to learn it only meant get lost. Moya found frequent use for it nonetheless, and it came with the added benefit of at least sounding terrible. Why are we here? She asked Beatrice. The little princess had insisted Moya accompany her to the battlements, but when they got there, they had done nothing but stare out at the plain of Kilcorth. In a hurry to get back to my father's hall, are you? Beatrice stood before an adjacent crenel, peering out. At her height, she could rest her chin on the stone without bending. Moya didn't bother answering the jeer that masqueraded as a question. Instead, she rotated, bending her knees and placing them against one merlon while putting her back against the other. She sat at a dizzying elevation, but she held nothing but contempt for heights. Still guilt-ridden, Moya contemplated jumping into the abyss. Compared with that drop, dangling her toes off Midian's wall was as frightening as swimming in a knee-deep pond. She'd have done it, if not for Tekchin, who continued to tether her. Although his injuries were extensive, Moya felt the Galantian had been slow in recovering from his wounds, and she suspected Beatrice. The little princess, Moya's mocking title for her, appeared interested in Moya staying put. Why? She had no idea. After the battle, Moya refused to forgive Beatrice for her betrayal. No matter how much the little princess tried to explain, that's how Moya saw it. She had known the tragedy that would occur and had done nothing to intervene. She hadn't even warned them.
You don't like it here, do you, Moya? Beatrice asked. The dwarf's voice was soft and gentle, soothing in a way that Moya didn't care for. It felt like a lie.
Plenty of hard stone and hatred. What's not to like? Imagine it without the guilt.
Would it be so bad here if you succeeded in your quest? If you returned to life, lived decades, and then died?
No chance of that.
Beatrice hummed to herself. She did that frequently, and Moya realized she despised it just as much as everyone else. It was the little princess's way of saying, "Ha ha, I know something you don't, and I'm not going to tell you." But if it were true, Beatrice pressed, would it be so bad? You and Tek-Chin here together?
No, Moya replied. If it was just me and Tek-Chin, if everyone else got out and Persephone was able to win the war,
wouldn't be bad at all. You need to remember that.
Why?
Beatrice placed her little hands on the Merlin as if she were doing vertical push-ups. She lowered her head and sighed. You have some rough times ahead. You're going to feel...
She gave up leaning against the stone. Instead, she folded her arms and rested them on the crenel, as if it were a windowsill, and she were laying her head down to sleep.
What am I going to feel? I don't want to say you're prone to self-loathing, but, well, you are. It doesn't take much for Moya to hate Moya. When that happens, you get ugly. You have a tendency to unintentionally hurt those around you. Then you hate yourself more, and matters spiral downward from there. Tek-Chin won't care. He's strong and understands more than you'll ever give him credit for. But there will be others. People for whom your words and actions will have a lasting impact. She won't be able to understand until it's too late. And what a terrible tragedy that will be for both of you.
Who are we talking about? Beatrice smiled.
You haven't met her yet, and won't for several years. But she'll be a lot like you, much to the dismay of you both. She lifted her head and, resting her chin on folded arms, looked out at Nephril. You see, the world is about to change. It will be a very different place from what it was when you were born, which wasn't all that different from when I was born. For so many generations, everything has stayed the same. But upheavals are coming. You and the others have started a landslide that won't be stopped. And the landscape will change as a result. So much is on its way. Writing, industry and engineering, trade, exploration, inventions beyond your imagination, kingdoms and empires.
What's an empire?
A huge realm made up of numerous kingdoms.
Beatrice frowned.
The upheaval that is necessary to give birth to it is difficult to explain. I've seen what's to come and still have problems grasping it all. The world will become so very different.
Yet, at its core, everything will be the same.
There is a continuous thread that has existed from the beginning. The invisible hand that moves the world forward, and another one that opposes that order. We are part of that epic struggle.
In the future, many people will refer to the conflict as good versus evil. And yet, from my viewpoint, seeing it all laid out, I find it hard to decide which is which.
That's another problem with seeing the future, by the way. Everyone thinks it's easy. You see something bad is going to happen, so the obvious solution is to stop it. But there are repercussions. Stopping one minor evil might create a greater one later on. You can see how that right there makes things tricky. But that's not all. It's not even the hardest part.
What is?
When you see the whole picture, the colours blend. Good and bad, light and dark, up and down. They can flip depending on time and place.
For example, right now you don't like me very much. You hate being here, and you hold clear ideas of right and wrong, what you want and don't want. But the next time I see you, you'll be a different person with a better understanding of the world. The present Moya and the future Moya would heartily disagree over many things. And if that can happen to one person, imagine what it's like to see that same shift through the eyes of millions and over thousands of years. Who's right and who is wrong? It doesn't merely depend on who you are, but when and where as well. Everything changes all the time, including yourself. Nothing can be trusted. It's as much a guessing game as a skill. And the goal itself hides or changes faces or flips altogether. Beatrice laughed bitterly. And I'm only an observer in all this. Well, mostly. The ball was kicked to me, so I kicked it back. But I'm not actually playing. I couldn't handle it. She shook her head in amazement. That's what it's all about, though. That's what each day is for. One more step that will bring the story closer to the end. We are merely observers. Still, each of us must play our part. We are only grains of sand, but without us there is no beach, no place for the final stand. So, in a very real sense, we are the footholds that future generations will rise up on to face one another and decide what is right and what is wrong, who wins and who loses, and what those prizes are. You seem to be telling me a lot, Moya said. You're not normally this chatty. Beatrice tilted her head to one side and smiled. I envy you, Moya, what you're a part of, what you're about to see. You have a center seat at the great banquet. Okay, now you've got me worried. Is something terrible about to happen to me? No, something wonderful, Beatrice pointed out through the crenel. Moya caught movement beyond the wall. Out on the plain, she saw a light. It streaked like a falling star, only it wasn't falling. The light sped from left to right. Only visible for a few seconds, the sight was phenomenal, moving Moya to tears.
Bryn!
Moya wiped her eyes long after the light had disappeared.
Thank you,
Moya told Beatrice. All of it finally made sense. The little princess had brought Moya up there to lessen her load. The trip wasn't an utter failure. Bryn would make it out. Maybe she'd learn something that could save Persephone and the army. The guilt wasn't gone, but the load was lighter.
It helps knowing she'll get out. Did she save Suri?
Beatrice grinned at her.
What? You told me everything else. You can't tell me that.
The dwarf continued to grin.
You're a wee scunner, aren't you? Why don't you a wee and bile your head, you wee jobby?
Moya was certain she'd unloaded a vile blast of homegrown insults at the little princess, but Beatrice remained undeterred. She continued to grin, only she did more than that. She beamed. That smile was powerful and tight, the way a person acted when they were bursting to tell a secret. Finally, she gave in.
You're not done.
Moya narrowed her eyes.
What do you mean? You don't get to stay here. You're going back, Moya. Going back? How's that going to work? Bryn has the key.
Moya looked out at the dim landscape, which appeared all the darker after Bryn's passing.
I figured as much. But she's also gone. I'll give Rain his sword. You get Tekchin up. Tell him I said, it's time. The two of you have been conspiring against me. I thought his recovery seemed too slow. We couldn't afford to take the chance that you'd do something stupid like jumping into the abyss. They're going to need you. So is the world. Beatrice smiled. No, Moya.
You are not done yet. You have a long road of troubles ahead before you can return to me, before you can take your final rest. And you don't have a lot of time. You're in a race now. The Queen saw Bryn just like we did. It will take her a little while to figure out exactly what that means. She'll waste time making the same assumption you just did, that once again, the key slipped through her grasp. She will fret, scream, and terrify everyone around. Then eventually, two things will dawn on her.
What two things?
That a streak of light as bright as that one could never abandon loved ones so long as hope remains. And the second, that in this place, light is hope.
Chapter 20. Unlocking the Key. In the years to come, my trip through Pyre may become so hazy that it feels like a dream. But I am sure it will never leave me completely. When I lie on my deathbed, I might feel doubt, but not dread, because such worries are born from the unknown, and I have seen what lies beyond. The Book of Bryn. Darkness, absolute and insoluble. Floating, drifting, rising, Bryn held on to the feather and felt like a bubble rising toward the surface where, like all bubbles, she would pop. Yet for a long, indefinable moment, she lingered in that peaceful ascension, not at all certain she wanted to reach the surface. Weight, light, and sound waited impatiently. Pain wanted in.
I have to go back.
But for the first time, she wasn't sure she wanted to. In that moment of indecision, her bubble bounced against the surface.
It's just so nice to be without pain, fear, and the weight of the world on my shoulders.
Bryn? Did she really want to go back to that world of work and hunger? Return to the cold and the heat, the sadness, so much suffering?
Bryn!
It was so nice seeing her parents again. Playing with Darby.
Bryn!
The bubble burst. A bright light hit her, then the sound of splashing water. And pain. She felt it in her chest, a burning married to a terrible weight that pressed down on every inch of her. A heaviness as if she were being crushed. Then convulsions racked her body, and she vomited from both her mouth and nose. All her muscles contracted as over and over she retched and water gushed, a foul, dirty flood ejecting from her lips as her stomach drove its contents up her throat.
Air! I need air! That's it, that's it. Cough it all up,
a woman said. Another burst of water was driven from her, and then she could breathe. She managed to pull in an exquisite banquet of air before it was cut off, this time by a series of violent coughs.
It's okay. You're fine now.
She didn't feel fine. Opening her eyes hurt, but she didn't have the strength to wipe them. Daylight and hazy figures were all she could see. A hand was on her back, a light reassuring pressure. Bryn was on her knees, doubled over on something cold and bright.
Snow?
Yes, snow. She could feel it crush under her. Grandmother of all, was she cold?
Cold as death.
She'd had no idea how literal that phrase was. Bryn blinked enough times to vaguely see out of her left eye. Her right was still blurred. She was on the bank next to the pool.
Ice. The pool is frozen over.
She saw a hole in the middle, jagged pieces floating in black water. I need to get you back home and get these wet clothes off. Are any others coming?
I...
That was all she could manage before her voice gave out. Her throat felt ragged and torn.
Don't try to talk yet.
She shook her head. Bryn felt herself lifted by someone's arms. She let her head fall, let it rock. That felt good. Her first nice feeling since returning to life. She fell asleep, or passed out. Either way, as she slept, her body must have done the work of living again. Heart beating, blood flowing, lungs drawing in air. For when she woke, she heard the crackle of a fire and felt its warmth. She was naked before a hearth, a blanket wrapped around her. She felt hands rubbing, scrubbing hard, shaking her whole body. She whimpered because being moved hurt. Her head throbbed and her limbs ached. "You're doing great," the woman said as she dried her hair. With eyes clear of muck, Bryn saw Muriel's face. She was in the woman's hut, which looked the same as before, except the windows were wreathed in snow. Brilliant sunlight flooded the interior, shooting in at a sharp angle. Bryn's nostrils remained lined with muck, and just like after a cold, she guessed it would be days before she was entirely free of the rank smell. Still, through that stench, she smelled something savory, and hunger woke with a fierce, desperate pang, a craven yearning that started her mouth salivating. "How long has it been since I ate? Ready for some soup?" Muriel gently lowered Bryn's head and moved toward the little chopping table, carefully threading her way through the dangling strings of stone that hung from the ceiling. Muriel found a wooden bowl and returned to the hearth, where Bryn noticed a blackened pot simmering over neatly stacked coals licked by little flames. "Such a perfect blaze. My mother would be so impressed. Even Padera would have to admit that is one fine cooking fire." Bryn caught herself staring. Not at anything, just looking. She didn't want to move, and that included her eyes. She wanted to let her mind roam, untethered. She didn't have the strength for anything else. Weak and heavy, her arms hung limp, her hands pooled in her lap, her bowed head making curtains of her hair. "My mother always brushed that aside. Drove her crazy. Did the same to Persephone, and..."
"How long was I gone?"
Bryn asked, her voice rough but working again. "A few days," Muriel replied.
"Only days? Are you certain?"
Turning her head and lifting her chin, Bryn looked once more at the brilliant snow-bounced light and the decorative frost wreathing the windows.
"Is that all? It felt like years."
Muriel knelt down before the hearth, grabbed up a stick, and used it to hook the arm that held the pot. It swung out and away from the fire.
"It's the snow." Muriel gestured at the windows with the stick.
"Makes the whole world look different. It got cold right after you left. I kept the ice open for you, just in case."
"Thank you."
Muriel pulled a thick rag from a hook and used it to lift the pot lid. She stirred the contents a few times, then spooned two full ladles into the bowl.
"Here,"
she said, holding it out.
"Careful, it's hot."
"Thank you again."
Bryn struggled to lift her arms, and she was surprised they still worked. She was able to take the bowl, which was warm to the touch. She brought it to her lips, thick, with a clear broth and plenty of root vegetables. "Some sort of stew," she guessed, but she didn't put much thought into it. Bryn was starved and would have poured the whole bowl down her throat if it hadn't been so hot. She sat, feeling the heat warm her chest, then settle into her stomach. Almost immediately, the throbbing in her head eased. The cold that had shaken her body receded. The aches and pains that had stabbed her muscles faded a bit. Bryn felt like a lantern whose wick had been lit once more. Tilting the bowl up, she took another swallow, and another, and then...
"The horn!"
Bryn looked down at herself, but aside from the blanket, she was naked. She looked at Muriel. She didn't have the horn either. Bryn scanned the hut in a growing panic.
"I lost it. It didn't come out with me."
When she started to stand up, Muriel placed a hand on her shoulder, pressing down.
I have it. Relax.
That wasn't going to satisfy Bryn, and Muriel appeared to know this. The woman got up and plucked the horn from atop Bryn's pile of wet clothes.
Is this what you were after?
I thought you said you were going to save a friend.
We thought so too.
Bryn took the horn. Its surface was still slick, and a little water dribbled out, leaving a wet stain on her blanket.
Do you know what it is?
You mean other than a ram's horn?
Yes.
Muriel shook her head and returned to stirring the pot.
But I know it's special.
Why do you say that?
Because you brought it out of Pyre.
Muriel replaced the lid and pushed the pot back over the fire. The metal arm squeaked a bit with the effort. Bryn stared at the horn in her lap. In all the time she'd carried it, she hadn't bothered to look. It seemed like nothing more than an old ram's horn, except there were markings. She thumbed over the surface, feeling the indentations. Writing. The symbols were hers.
Gift am I. Of Pharaoh's hand these laws to halt the chaos be. No king shall die, no tyrant cleaved, save by the perilous sound of me. Cursed the silent hand that strikes, forever to his brethren lost. Doomed to darkness and bereft of light, so be the tally and the cost. Breathe upon my lips and announce the gauntlet loud, so all may hear thy challenge for the kingly seat. So all may gather, and none need fear. But once upon 1,003, unless by death you hear me cry, no challenge, no dispute precedes a generation left to die. Upon the sound of challenge cast, a battle of contenders will ensue. Combat will begin and last until there be but one of two. A bond formed betwixt opponents, protected by Pharaoh's hand, from all save the blade, the bone, and skill of the other's hand. Should champion be called to fight, evoked is the hand of Pharaoh, which protects the championed from all, and champion from all, save one, from peril. Battle is the end for one. For the other, all shall sing. For when the struggle at last is done, the victor shall be king.
It says the winner will be king, Bryn said. She looked at Muriel. It doesn't say Fane. That's what the leader of the fray is called.
Muriel shrugged.
Fane is actually a name. The first ruler of the fray was Glyndora Fane, and all other leaders adopted her name. King is what the world's first ruler called himself.
Yes, Bryn said, nodding. He did, and the fray couldn't read this anyway, so I suppose it was never meant for them. This is a message for others, for people in the future.
She looked toward the windows again.
At the slant of light, so sharp the sun had to be low. Is it morning or evening?
Morning. Sun just came up. I need to get going.
Bryn pushed to her feet, surprised she could.
That one bowl of soup had done wonders. I need to run.
Seriously? That's ambitious.
What about the others?
Won't they be coming?
Bryn hesitated. Wavering on her bare legs,
she bit her lip as it began to quiver.
Maybe? I'm not sure. But I can't wait for them. I left the key inside in case they make it.
Muriel's brows rose.
It's in safe hands, but it'll only be there a short while. If no one gets back to the rail gate soon, it'll be given to you.
This made Muriel's mouth drop.
Me? Sorry to impose. You will keep it for Turin, won't you?
Muriel didn't answer.
The whole thing. It was harder than we thought.
Bryn let out a sad little laugh at the absurdity of the statement. She looked again at the windows, at the light creeping across the floor.
I have to get back to the dragon camp before the sun sets tonight, or everything we went through will be for nothing. I have to get the horn to Nephron.
How far do you have to go?
It hit her then, slapped her hard as she remembered the distance. The trip to the swamp was less than a day's travel, but the trip through Ith had taken all night. She didn't have that much time, and in her present state she felt a rising panic.
I really do have to go.
Bryn grabbed her wet clothes, which were so soaked they dripped. They were as cold as ice. The soup, that miraculous meal, had helped, but she still felt tired and a bit dizzy. The idea of putting on those wet things, of wearing them out into the winter snow, Bryn had forgotten the agony of living. But it came back with a crash. Clinging to the blanket, she couldn't help it. She started crying.
In Pyre, I was so fast and strong. But here, it's so cold, and there's snow. I've so far to go, and then there is the swamp. I'll have to wait for that tidal bridge or swim across and hope that thing doesn't eat me. Oh, grandmother of all, give me strength.
The tunic fell from her hands, and she heard it hit the floor with a sodden slap that sprayed her ankles. Muriel came to her with a sympathetic frown and pulled her into a hug.
I'm sorry. The world is an ugly place.
Trust me, I know. A perfect piece of glorious fruit that has since turned black with rot.
But I'm supposed to make it better. We went to change things. That's why Turin sent us. He's trying to fix things, and sending us through Pyre was a step in that direction.
Turin isn't interested in fixing the world. Your mistake was putting faith in him.
But then, a lot of people made that error. He is evil. Bryn shook her head.
No.
You're wrong about him.
No, I'm not.
You are. I know you are.
She sounded like an impetuous child, even to herself. How foolish she must sound to Muriel. Still, Bryn knew she was right, but she couldn't adequately explain. Some things were just beyond the realm of words and gestures. Some truths, the most basic ones, refused to be denied.
You've known him for what? A few years?
Muriel said.
Turin is my father. I've known him, well, almost since time began. He's cruel, self-centered, unrelenting.
He's changed.
Bryn cut off what she thought might be a long list, all of which was irrelevant.
He's trying to make amends. I know he is. He wants to be good, and he can be.
Yeah, right. When trees walk and stones talk.
Bryn pulled back and stared at Muriel.
What did you say?
Muriel didn't register her surprise. The woman was dug in, still focused on Turin and working at proving her point.
I just meant it's not possible.
Turin is... No, that's not what you said.
Bryn held Muriel at arm's length, watching her face and searching it for answers. She was looking for verification.
You said... When trees walk and stones talk.
Bryn reached up and carefully drew Muriel's hair back from her left ear, revealing a large freckle. The woman brushed her hand away, annoyed.
What are you doing?
The freckle is there. I knew it would be.
And you have a space between your teeth. I'm betting you can whistle through it. Can you?
Bryn was starting to bounce on the balls of her feet as the energy of excitement grew. Muriel stared at her.
How do you know that?
Because you're Muriel, Bryn said.
I know who I am, and so do you.
Yes, but I'm in such a hurry. If I didn't hear you say that thing about stones and trees, I would have forgotten to tell you.
Tell me what? He called you really. Muriel.
Bryn said, listening to how the words sounded. Muir Real. Really. It's a nickname. Your nickname.
Muriel stepped away from Bryn. She staggered backward, threatening to overturn the stool behind her. She didn't respond at first. She didn't have to. Everything was on her face.
How do you know all this?
She finally asked. I've read about you.
You did what?
It's a long story. There are tablets in the Agave, carved thousands of years ago, and I know what they said. Many of them are all about you. Trilos made them.
Muriel's arms fell limply to her sides. She took another step back, and the stool finally toppled with a clack.
Did you say Trilos?
Muriel remained staring at her. In her eyes, Bryn could read the entire story as easily as she had read the tablets.
Yes, and that's not all. I met him.
Muriel bent down, right at the stool, and sat. She was breathing hard. No longer looking at Bryn, she studied the floorboards with great interest.
You actually saw him? You spoke to Trilos in Pyre?
No, not there. I saw him in Estramnadon. Muriel looked up.
No,
she shook her head. That's not possible. He died and went to Pyre.
Everyone, he escaped,
Bryn told her. Trilos was in Pyre. He was in the Abyss of Nifril, but he managed to escape. It happened long, long ago.
Muriel was still shaking her head.
No.
She stood up defiantly.
He couldn't have. No one can leave Pyre. Not without the key. And if he did, he would have... The first thing he would have done is... No. No!
She kicked a basket of stones, scattering them across the floor.
Trilos is still in Pyre. He's trapped there. He can't get out. He has to be. He has to be.
Muriel's brow was furrowed. Her gaze shifted around the room as if searching for something. Then she turned sharply, and with an angry, accusing tone, she asked,
If he escaped, why hasn't he come to me? I'm not hard to find. Even you found me.
Bryn felt devastated. The answer was unspeakable. If their situations were reversed, Bryn thought how debilitating it would be to learn such a thing about Tesh. How many times worse must it be for Muriel? The person known as the Tetlin Witch hadn't found her way to this spot in the swamp by accident. She was like Aunt Nida's dog, Apple, curled up and waiting for the one person she cared for the most. Waiting through eternity.
You know,
Muriel said, her eyes narrowing.
Tell me.
Bryn hated doing this, and this time the idea of lying did cross her mind, but she couldn't bring herself to do it. She had no experience, no skill at deception. But more than that, the idea repulsed her. Bryn was a keeper, trained to speak the truth and taught to believe in the sacred value of honesty. She could no more deceive than she could fly. Bryn took a breath.
He's forgotten you.
Muriel blinked.
Forgotten me?
Yes, Bryn began slowly, trying to be as kind as she could. But there was no way to soften this blow.
Trilos sacrificed the one thing he had left. His love for you.
He gave up his memories, killing his only joy.
The pain, the anguish of that sacrifice gave him the power to punch a hole between the worlds, but it erased you.
Muriel continued to stare at her, and Bryn had no idea if Muriel believed her or not. Then the tears slipped down the woman's cheeks. Feeling like she'd stabbed a friend, Bryn reached out for her, but Muriel retreated, raising her hands to ward off the keeper. Her shoulders rose as her entire body cringed.
But he saved you too.
Bryn offered as a sort of consolation. He preserved his memories. Muriel's face remained a mask of despair and bewilderment.
He wrote everything down, carved it in stone.
Bryn showed her a smile, but it wasn't much of one. Bryn didn't have much to give, but she gave what she had to show Muriel that all might not be lost.
He left himself a record of everything he knew or felt about you, just like I wanted to do with my parents. I did it so future generations would know them as I had. But Trilos, I think Trilos left the memories for himself. He stacked them neatly in pyre, where they would never be touched. That's where I found them. That's how I learned about the two of you. He wrote down how he met you, how you two fell in love. I know everything he felt. Trilos worked at capturing all the little details, pouring all he knew, all he remembered of you, into those words. I think he put them there, so one day he might somehow reclaim what he lost. But...
what? Muriel took a step back toward her.
I'm not sure he even knows the tablets exist, or realizes their importance.
You said you read them?
Muriel grabbed her arms.
What does that mean?
Bryn nodded.
It's a form of communication. Something I invented. Well, Trilos helped, too. It's difficult to explain, but it lets me know everything he thought and felt.
And you're a keeper. You can remember it all, can't you?
Bryn thought a moment and recalled the golden field on a spring morning.
Yes. Yes, I can.
And you met him, so you know what he looks like and where he is. You can find him again and give back his memories.
Muriel crossed the small distance between them and grabbed hold of the blanket, tugging Bryn close.
Oh, please, Bryn. Please. I beg you. Please do this for me.
Outside, a wind whipped up. It whistled, then howled. Snow flew past the windows, making them dark, then light, then dark again. Muriel took no notice of the sudden storm. Her eyes were fixed on Bryn's. Then she seemed to stretch, to grow taller. As she did, the little door began to rattle.
The Tetlin Witch.
There's something else, Bryn said.
What is it?
When trees walk and stones talk, is a message your father sent me as a reminder. He wanted me to let you know that Trilos is no longer trapped in pyre, to give you hope that the two of you can be reunited. I'm right about him trying to fix things. He knew I would be in a hurry and would have rushed right out of here without telling you. But that didn't happen because he went to so much trouble to plant that phrase of yours in my head. Your father lived with us for many years. But when he found out that someone escaped from the Agave, he left. He must have been looking for proof that it was Trilos. And when he found out, he sent that message to me in pyre.
No!
Muriel shook her head. Her face was harsh, cold, and as close to the proverbial Tetlin witch as any woman could hope to achieve.
Flash! White light burst through the windows as lightning streaked across the winter sky. Thunder cracked and Bryn screamed. Seeing Muriel that way was terrifying.
You don't know my father,
Muriel said through clenched teeth.
I do. He's beyond manipulative and extremely clever. He shouldn't use people like you. You're a nice girl, Bryn. And he... but of course, that's why he picked you.
Malcolm didn't pick me. I...
don't be naive. Of course he chose you.
Nothing happens by coincidence around my father.
He controls everything. I thought he was done trying to control me.
The wind blew so hard outside that some thatch peeled off the roof, letting puffs of snow spill in. The front door rattled louder. Outside, Bryn could hear trees creaking, Some cracked. Again lightning flashed, and once more thunder followed. Bryn continued to pour out all she could to stifle the wildfire she had ignited.
I spoke to Elan. She wants Turin to fix the world, to repair the damage he's done, and she thinks he can. She believes he will. And she's known him for even longer than you.
You spoke to her, too?
Once more Muriel studied Bryn, this time less out of skepticism and more from awe.
She told me everything. She believes Turin has changed, or is trying to. He knows how much pain he caused, and that everyone hates him, especially you.
Bryn's eyes widened then as the thought struck her, both sensible and poetic. The beauty shook her.
Muriel, Turin gave us a key of great worth, but it wasn't the one that unlocked Pyre. It's you. You're the key. You'll decide everything.
None of this was ever about Suri, or a horn, or even Trilos.
It's about you. That's why he sent me. He wanted us to have this conversation. It's why he sent me the message in Pyre. He sent me to unlock the key.
Muriel stared at Bryn. The woman's breathing slowed, and she began to nod. As she did, the wind stopped rattling the door.
He chose very well when he picked you. Sunlight reappeared,
flickering in through the windows.
I'm not saying I believe everything you said, and as much as I hate doing exactly what my father wants me to, I can't deny that our paths travel in the same direction, which means getting that horn to Nephron in time.
And I can help with that. Pick up your clothes. Bryn bent down and grabbed the pile. Her tunic and cloak were dry. Dry and warm.
I can't do anything about the distance you must run between Ith and where you came from. That's a struggle you face on your own.
But you needn't fear the swamp. It will be your friend and aid you in your travel.
Thank you.
Muriel nodded.
And when you are done with your trip, you'll go to Trilos.
Yes,
Bryn promised.
Although I don't think that will be necessary. There's a good chance he'll be trying to find me.
And you'll tell him about me?
Yes.
And I'll do even better than that. I'll do what Trilos did, but I won't leave it in the bottom of the abyss. I'll write it all down in the Book of Bryn.
Chapter 21. The Sun Goes Down.
Up, down, up, down. This is how we cover ground.
I know it is stupid, but it is true. I wish I had a lot more stew.
The Book of Bryn. Persephone looked up at the sound of shouts, hammers, and running feet, and for a moment, for a terrible, horrible instant, she was certain the end had come. She had been watching the sunlight move across the fabric of the tent. Morning had arrived and departed, and the diminished light of a deepening winter shortened the day. She remembered Malcolm's dire tone the night before. Taken together with what she had seen, or thought she'd seen, in his eyes, she felt justified about her unsteady nerves. When a man capable of seeing the future warned of impending disaster by nightfall, it was hard not to be scared of the dark. Down for his afternoon nap, Nolan was still asleep in a wad of blankets he had twisted around his body. His little legs, having kicked free of the coverings, were splayed out, taking up much of the bed. Despite what sounded like a battle being waged just outside, the boy didn't stir. Justine, who had also napped, was awake and hastily pulling on her dress. From the look on her face, she didn't want to die wearing only her shift.
"What's happening?" she asked.
"Keep an eye on him," Persephone ordered, jerking on her boots. She grabbed a cloak from the pile and rushed out. Sharp, angled streaks of sunlight were blinding. Men burst through the white,
rushing past carrying bundles of rope. Not a weapon was out. This was her first clue to the mystery of the clamour, a positive sign. Then to her left, Persephone saw a tent list dramatically and deflate.
"What's going on?" she asked a man running past. "Breaking camp, my Koenig."
"Breaking? Why?"
But the man had already run by. Persephone struggled to pull the cloak around her and realized she'd grabbed Justine's by mistake. The nurse was much smaller, and the fabric didn't reach all the way around Persephone, leaving an inch-wide gap showing the dull white of her gown. With a scowl, she rushed to where the tent was collapsing. A dozen men stood around as others worked with shovels and mallets to free the stakes. The tent had been a place for storing raw wool, which had been rolled, tied in bundles, and stacked. By the time she arrived, three more poles had been pulled from three other tents.
"Stop!" she shouted at the workers. "What are you doing?"
They all looked up, startled and nervous. No one responded.
"Why are you taking this down?"
She focused on a man with a mallet. He looked familiar to her, but he wasn't from Wren. Still, she'd seen him often around the camp, usually hauling water or wood.
"We were told to," the man replied.
"By whom?"
"Nephron, ma'am. Where is he?"
Several pointed down the line of collapsing tents, giant flattened canvas footprints that marked the evidence of her husband's passing.
"Well, stop what you're doing and get that wool off the snow and back inside."
As she walked away, one called out,
"Does that mean we aren't leaving?"
Persephone didn't answer. She kept on trudging, feeling the hard-packed snow crush under her steps. With every stride, she felt more furious with him.
"How dare he order an evacuation without asking me? Without even telling me?"
She spotted Nephron down the line of flattened tents, waving his hands and shouting.
"Are you still drunk?" she asked upon reaching him. "What's going on?"
"Scouts just reported spotting the Fane's army at the forest's edge, and I personally saw leathery wings circle over the trees just moments ago. We cannot stay any longer."
"We have to stay here."
"Why?"
"Because Malcolm said so."
Nephron stared at her, confused.
"Did you say because Malcolm said so?"
"Yes, and he was quite adamant."
"I don't care if he was naked in the snow and swearing like a lunatic. He doesn't command this army. We do."
"But," she began, "Persephone, last night the horn was blown. Do you know what that means?"
"Yes, you all explained the whole succession of rulers quite well. And I meant what it means to us."
She didn't, and had no idea what he was getting at. So she waited to be enlightened.
"After creating his first dragon, Lothian began building an army to attack with. He's extended the Avampartha bridges and marched troops across the Nidwalden. He has the Spider Corps training, and he's made more dragons. A lot more.
I've heard the reports, just like you."
"What you didn't hear, what neither of us knew until this morning, was that those troops began marching up the same road I built, and dragons are coming with them. They are just inside the trees now."
"Persephone,